down to business on News Talk.
Thanks to Bank of Ireland, helping you get ready for Brexit.
A very good morning to you wherever you are. You're very welcome to Saturday's Down to Business. As always, this is the show that gets behind how things really work in Irish business. We're live here in the Collection Hotel for our special roadshow, Your Town, Your Main Street. We've all sorts of fascinating people on the show this morning. We'll be giving Portlaoise a health check with our town team of experts. The Super Mac himself, Pat McDonough, will be joining me shortly. I'll be talking to the Governor of Portlaoise Prison. And there'll be all sorts of things, Leash. We'll even have an Offaly man, Tom Parlin, here from the CAF. We've given him a special pass to talk to us here in the county of Leash today. You can text us here, 53106. It'll only cost you 30 cents, or email me at downtobusiness@newstalk.com. I'm open on Twitter at Bobby Kerr. We have a special hashtag today, BobbyBizPortlaoise. We have a big crowd here in front of us in the Collection Hotel. I'm not sure if they're awake yet. Yep, they're here. Yeah, lovely to see everybody. Thank you all for coming out. There's a big crowd here in the Collection this morning. We were in town here in Portlaoise yesterday. Walked the land, as they say. Got a sense of the town. Went out to Abbey Leakes. Met the wonderful Helen G out there, and she showed me how to make jam. Hopefully we'll hear a bit about that later on. So we're delighted to be here. This is a very, very popular and strong Midlands town, geographically located, equidistant from Dublin and Cork, and a really, really good location. So you're going to be hearing lots about what Portlaoise has to offer a bit later in the show. We start the show, though, as we always do. We're looking at the front pages and indeed the business pages of today's papers. I'm delighted to be joined by Laura Coates. She's the managing editor of the Leinster Leader. And Stephen Miller is the owner and managing editor of LeashToday.ie. You're both very welcome. And to give us a local perspective on things, we'll start with the headline, if we may, Stephen, in the Irish Daily Mail. A Sinn Féin backlash, they're calling it. Tell us more.
Yeah, I suppose when I got a call last week from your producer to say we're going to be going through the papers, I wonder what'll be on the papers now on Saturday week. I said it'll still be government formation talks, and I said if you came back in May, we probably could still be talking about the same thing. So look, I was in the Dáil during the week. For the TDs arrived from all over the country for their first day back, and you could sense the excitement. There was great sort of carnival atmosphere outside Leinster House on Thursday morning. But by the time I was home that evening and seen the 9 o'clock news, the anger was already there. You had Mary Lou and Micheál Martin attacking each other. And yesterday then you had the story of Drew Harris coming out and saying that the IRA Army Council are still given, or still
the timing still of that is a little bit weird, is it not? Well, not weird, but it's unusual, is it not? Why would he say such a thing at this time?
Well, he was at the unveiling of the new guards yesterday in Templemore. He was asked by the press, government formation talks are, you know, in process at the moment. It's an obvious question. It has come up more than often. Like Micheál Martin and Mary Lou at each other in the Dáil the previous evening. I think it was an obvious question. It's been mentioned more than once. In the, you will get the cynics and the Sinn Féin supporters will say that the timing of it is... You know, why now? Like this isn't a new report. He's saying that the report hasn't changed.
It was in November, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Laura, your own thoughts on the story. What about the editorial in the Irish Independent? Sinn Féin must disavow its hooded past if it wants to win trust. And again, that quote says, what prompted Garda Commissioner Drew Harris to confirm a five-year-old PSNI report claiming the IRA maintains an overarching command structure overseeing Sinn Féin is not clear. That's what they're saying.
Yeah, I mean, the editorial certainly comes out strongly, and you know, even the headline of it, Sinn Féin must disavow its hooded past if it wants to win trust. So it's certainly a very strong line that it's taking there. I mean, a quote I thought was very interesting from it. It will be, Sinn Féin, it will be haunted forever with what Thomas Jefferson described as a sanguinary hue until it steps away from the shadows.
Yeah.
And it did say that, you know, whatever prompted Drew Harris's comments yesterday, that they must be taken seriously. So I mean, that's a very strong line on that, and that if Mary Lou and her party are serious about playing a role in government, that they must be able to convince their coalition partners that, you know, that of their credentials, especially where these allegations regarding the Army Council are concerned.
Yeah, and another one-liner in that same editorial says, just as one cannot be a bit pregnant, one cannot be a bit democratic. There you go.
Certainly you're all in or you're all out on this, I think. That's the line.
On that note, we'll move to the next story, which is an interesting one, I think, because I think hospital cuisine and hospital food has been much the subject of debate over many years. And this article by Conor Pope in today's Irish Times, serving up a solution to the problem of hospital food, a lady called Joyce Timmons, she's a Michelin star chef. She manages, I believe, the Rotunda Hospital and has changed things around massively around hospital food. What did you make of this article?
I thought it was very interesting.
Isn't it?
You know, I thought it would be something that is not rocket science where it comes to food, but it seems that the service of food in our hospitals has been caught up with a quagmire of bureaucracy, the same as a lot of things perhaps in the health service. I mean, what she's suggesting, and this is a lady who has a huge background in Michelin-starred cooking, is that fresh food be served, fresh, nutritious food be served, and that, you know, she says that the chefs in the hospital, just they're not inspired anymore. They're plating up stuff that's been pre-prepared and pre-cooked. She wants to see a system brought in where there's a panel of expert chefs nearly coordinating food services in the hospitals across the country, and that they essentially direct new, fresh menus on a two-week basis. And,
yeah, I mean, very interesting. Stephen, there's been a report in the UK that they've spent over 50 million in the UK to improve the quality of hospital food. Reports suggest 17 separate government initiatives since 2000 have led to no discernible improvement in the food. So it's easier said than done. Well, it's tackling this problem.
Well, it's like a lot of these things. Money isn't always the answer. It's a change in culture and a change in approach. There was a very simple suggestion in that there was no brown bread toast option in the hospitals. Like if they could switch from white bread to brown bread, that's one simple change that could be made straight away. You know, it is very, very like, and you see how can staff in that industry be motivated to work in those circumstances? You will see anywhere you go where staff are proud of where they work, you get that sense from them, and if that is the case in an industry like that, it's
interesting to see as well. J.P. McMahon, again, the Galway restaurateur, he writes for the Irish Times, like he's saying that if there's such a link between nutrition and health, how can hospital food be so bad? Which is, again, a very pragmatic thing to say, that if because surely you want people to get better, and if food is a way of making them better, that should be the focus.
Yeah, it's a great irony, really. And your next story is a good one.
Which is, hospital meals are disrupted after a dead mouse is found in the kitchen. This is in University Hospital in Galway. Again, just another story to tie in with hospital food, and again, some difficulties there.
Yeah, you'd feel sorry for anyone who's in hospital in Galway this particular week. the main inconvenience that their hot meal was changed from the middle of the day to the evening, but I think there's a few other issues in the background there too, unfortunately.
All right, let's move on. And this is a technology and business story. It concerns Bobby Healy and his quest to basically tie in the sky. He's collaborated with Brody Sweeney and Camille Thai. And they're going to be delivering Thai food by drone within weeks in South Dublin. Isn't that amazing?
Unbelievable, yeah. Absolutely unbelievable. About 30,000 homes in South Dublin are going to be in the catchment area, delivered in 3 minutes to your home from ordering. You give a landing zone for your takeaway to be delivered on a patio or whatever, and it can be dropped.
The dog. When you read this kind of story, you say that's science fiction or that's futuristic. This is happening.
It's happening, and it's happening now. I mean, did we even think, 20 years ago that, you'd be buying online, clicking, collecting even your groceries, clicking and having your groceries delivered by van? This is just another step, The technology is there, so...
Bobby Healy, has pedigree in terms of car trawler and his history. He's not a fellow who's messing around. No. Like, this is going to happen. And I think the collaboration now with Brody Sweeney, I'm really excited about about this.
And like, it's going to scale quite quickly as well. I see like 50,000 delivery drones in Ireland and the UK quite quickly. So yeah, it's a huge, incredibly exciting development, and it's definitely one we're keeping an eye on.
Okay, we'll keep an eye on that. Business story then, if we look at Kingspan's profits, up 12% to 500 million. The building materials company amasses a 750 million war chest to fund acquisitions. And Jean Murta there speaking, maybe about a concerned start for 2020, but very, very strong 2019 numbers.
It's great to see like an incredible success story of that scale and that nature. You know, it's just and to have that war chest to play with. Like the interesting point I picked up from that was that the average acquisition takes about 8 years in the making. So they've been building this success for quite a long time, and they're going nowhere and getting bigger and stronger the whole time.
And he also says that, which is interesting as well from a strategic point of view, that they only acquire companies that they know well, which I assume means that the success rate is probably far higher than most companies.
Yeah, not taking speculation, kind of going with what they know.
Laura, what about that other article relating to Jean Murta? He quotes basically, and this is interesting with Brexit and all that's happening, because Kingspan is a major player in the UK market, but he seems to think that Ireland could benefit, and as would Belgium and the Netherlands, if the immigration laws, which are going to be changed in the UK, prevent construction, migrants effectively, that we could get the upside of that.
Absolutely. I mean, there would be a huge skills shortage, you know, coming in Ireland, as you know, as well as here in Ireland at the moment, in terms of, you know, workers for the construction industry. And if they are barred, you know, if migrants are barred from entering the UK, perhaps particularly those that wouldn't pass these stringent new requirements that are coming in, Ireland will be a beneficiary of that. You know, near neighbour, English-speaking country, people will come here, and it could be an absolute benefit to Ireland, you know, to have that labour force arriving on our doorsteps, as well as for Belgium and the Netherlands, obviously.
And surprising as well, Stephen, that the UK government would take such an initiative, given that they've got full employment.
Yeah, full employment is you know, when we're at full employment here, or as close to it as is possible, so to take that initiative in that context is very interesting. And Ireland, you would imagine, as an English-speaking country, quite close, is going to benefit in that regard.
Yeah, okay. And then finally, as we have a story, don't muck with the bacon and cabbage, page 3 of the Irish Daily Mail. He's known for his eclectic range of flavours, but it appears Mr. Tato may have gone too far this time with the bacon and cabbage crisps. Any reaction? Shock, horror.
Shock, horror, indeed. I saw this all over social media last night, and the reactions sort of range from absolute, I was just like, no, this can't happen. But the reactions range from absolute shock, horror, disbelief, to people kind of going, yeah, but I'm going to get a bag and have a try anyway. I thought it was interesting, Eddie Coffey there in the Mail, actually, you know, who is apparently a connoisseur of bacon and cabbage, was nominated by his colleagues to go in and have a go. And he was a bit disappointed. You know, he said they didn't quite taste like bacon and cabbage. They were sort of slightly removed from cheese and onion with a distant threat of salt and vinegar.
He said they're like a cross between salt and vinegar and cheese and onion. So it's
that's not
clearly some
review.
Synthetic flavour. What did you make of it, Stephen?
Tato tried this previously when they made a chocolate bar, a Tato-flavoured chocolate bar. And as someone said to me, they ruined both chocolate and Tato while they were doing it. So I think this similar project is going to end up. And those bars didn't last too long on the shelves.
Listen, I want to thank you both for a great review of the papers. Laura Coates, the managing editor of the Leinster Leader, and Stephen Miller, the owner and managing editor of leashtoday.ie. Give them a round of applause. Now, I just wanted to say as well that IE Domain Register, big thanks to them. They're sponsoring today's show. So thanks to that. That's .ie, the home of .ie, IE Domain Registry. So your town, your main street, brought to you by them. And my next guest is Pat McDonough. He's one of Ireland's best-known business people, mostly due to his creation of Supermax, but he's also so much more. Most people associate him with Galway, but you may be surprised to learn that the hotel that we're actually broadcasting today from, the Collection, is part of his portfolio. Good morning to you, Pat. How are you?
Good morning, Bobby.
How are things?
Great, thanks, Neil. You're welcome to Portlaoise.
Yeah, and as a Galway man, you seem to be almost like an honorary Portlaoise man. You've been doing business in this county for a long number of years, Pat.
Yeah, we're in Portlaoise. We opened our first Supermax here in Portlaoise about 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And it has been very successful for us. So we invested here in the Collection Hotel in 2015. And that's working out well for us as well. So we're delighted with the progress. And as you know, we're building a plaza out at the junction on the motorway. So we're hoping to open that by June.
Okay, so the your business clearly has evolved. You've got three effective arms. You've got the fast food arm of the Supermax, great brand, then six hotels in the portfolio, and then what, six or seven plazas as well?
Correct, yeah. And as I say, you know, business evolves from what we started, I suppose, 42 years ago. And so you have to keep moving with the times. And the motorways have changed the face of the country. And here in Portlaoise, it's no different to anywhere else. And I think the motorways helped Portlaoise. I see Portlaoise, as I say, as the centre of the crossroads of the country. It's a fantastic place for meetings, you know, sporting events, etc. And, you know, there's a great atmosphere and the great entrepreneurship in the town through both the council under John Mulholland, who are very forward-thinking, and indeed, obviously, the Chamber of Commerce and all the other aspects of town, Gardaí and other enterprise as well. So it's one of those towns that I would say is progressing fantastically well and is making use of whatever benefits they can get.
Going to be talking to a lot of the traders and a lot of the people from the town later on. But Pat, can I ask you about your own thoughts? Like, did you have a strategy to get into hotels, or how opportunistic are you in relation to now? People would say that maybe you bought those hotels fairly right, as they say, in that you didn't pay too much for any of them. Would that be fair comment?
You can ask the bank manager about one or two of those. I think he wasn't on the same page as myself on them. But anyway, the first one I got into totally by accident, because I had been looking for a drive-through site just opposite the university in Limerick.
Yeah.
And the lady I was trying to buy it from, I had cups of coffee with her in the Castle Troy Park on at least 15 or 20 occasions. And she was a beautiful older lady, but she couldn't ever decide whether she wanted to sell or she didn't want to sell. So eventually the hotel came for sale and I decided to buy the hotel instead. And as I say, it has proven really worthwhile.
And was it because of that then you decided, look, I've made a success of this hotel, there's got to be more opportunity in this sector?
Absolutely. As I say, we were finding it very difficult at that time to get planning permissions in different areas for different reasons. So you were kind of being stagnated in what you were doing. So the hotel was there. It had been established for 20 years or whatever it was before that. And it was probably good value at the time, but that was 10 years ago at least at this stage. And as I say, it was a good opportunity, location. So, and when the first one works well for you, then it gives you the confidence to go and move on from there. So we moved to Loughrea, I think it was after that.
And when we look at the development of the motorway services businesses now, you drive down any of the motorways, they're well populated with forecourts, with food and beverage propositions. Where has all that business come from? You know, like, what has it displaced?
Well, it probably has come from convenience, basically. And, you know, I would see that, say, in the likes of the Galway Plaza, that people from South Mayo and even as far up as Castlebar would drive to the motorway in Tuam and then go on to Dublin that way, because, you know, it's time-saving and it's an easier drive. So the motorways have changed the face of the country. Unfortunately for smaller towns, and I would know from towns that have been bypassed, say the likes of Moat or Neen or places like that, you lose 30% of your business overnight.
Does it come back in time?
It comes back slowly, but not from the same content, because it's all about convenience.
Yeah.
It's not from the same customer. It comes back from trying other avenues of gaining customers. And so therefore, as I said, it was a natural progression to look for motorway sites, because again, having been to America and seeing what's happening there and England and the continent, that's the way it works.
Yeah.
It's really convenience driven.
Yeah, and oh, it's a fascinating sector, and again, one that has exploded over the years. Can I ask you about business generally, Pat? How do you feel about things like the coronavirus, tourism, Brexit? Let me ask you about insurance. You've been very vocal on that in the past. I see motor premiums are starting to come down. Is there any sight of premiums coming down in business insurance?
Not so much in the business sector. In fact, we would see them probably increase. And it's an area where, as I say, it could be addressed, but there needs to be a willingness on the government to address it. The 2004 Civil Liabilities Act, which was enacted back, as I say, at the time there was a previous issue with the insurance, worked very well when PIAB were allowed to address insurance claims. But then, obviously, the legal profession took 21 different judicial reviews to change.
There's too many vested interests at play, not only the legal profession.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. But if you look where the money goes, who's making the money from it? It's the legal profession, it's the insurance companies themselves, sometimes it's the claimants, but they're probably a third party. And then there's ancillary brokers, etc., making money from it. So it can be addressed, as I say, if the laws that were enacted at that stage in relation to, there was to be a register of claimants set up by the courts. That never happened. And when you have a situation where 95% of claims are settled outside the courts, well, then obviously there isn't too much confidence in bringing them into court. And when you have a barrister telling you before a court case, well, if you go before Judge X, you're going to get X result. If you go before Judge Rye, you have a fair chance.
Yeah.
So settle it before you win, basically.
Is there an argument, Pat, for a business the scale of yours employing 4,000 odd people that you should be self-insured? Have you ever considered that?
We are pretty much self-insured in a lot of the businesses, but we're not an insurance company, and so therefore it's a distraction to a certain degree for us. But at the same time, we do a better job, we feel, than what the insurance company does.
Yeah.
Because the insurance companies are too inclined to settle cases on a financial basis. They don't want to incur the cost of bringing it to court, etc., and fighting the claim. So they settle quite readily.
Right.
And whereas we would believe in fighting them if we think we're right.
Let me ask you finally then about your sense of 2020, the next 6, 9, 12 months in your various sectors, hotels, forecourts. Are you optimistic or relatively pessimistic?
Well, you have always to be optimistic,
yeah.
But you have to look at the reality of the situation. You know, the coronavirus is certainly going to have an effect on tourism. We've at this stage in the hotel side of the business lost probably close to $500,000 in cancellations.
Have you?
So you have to now address that and get it from somewhere else. However, you know, the strength of sterling is going to help us because we'd lost quite a bit of tourism generally of the UK market because of the weakness of sterling over the last number of years. But that has changed around even in the last few weeks. So there's a market that we can address. And then, of course, you know, who's going to go, if you look at tourism, who's going to go on a cruise ship for the next couple of months? I think you'd be a very courageous person to kind of book your cruise now.
Big shout out for the cruise industry there by Pat McDonough.
But at any rate, you know, therefore there's a market there that those people may be going, and the cruisers would have diverted I think, you know, Irish tourism has a lot to offer, and I think we're well regarded, and I think, during the last crisis, which was probably, well, even if you look at back a couple of years ago, where there were bombs going off in Central Europe, I think we benefited from that. So you have to make it happen if you're in the game and find out what's happening out there.
Well, Pat, it's a pleasure as always to talk to you. Thanks for hosting us here today, and every success to you and Una in the business. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks very much.
Pat McDonough, ladies and gentlemen. Our last guest, Pat McDonough, I've got good and bad news for him. The good news is that he forgot to mention that there's a wedding fair here in the Collection Hotel tomorrow, and I'm telling you that on his behalf. The bad news is that there's a travel agent in the audience who isn't happy with his position on cruise ships, so there you go. Good and bad news for Pat McDonough. Now you're listening to our special roadshow, Your Town, Your Main Street, live here in the Collection Hotel in Portlaoise. The show is brought to you by IE Domain Registry, home of .ie. Now, as all these shows, we do a little health check with our panel of experts with the town that we're in. They've all been here either yesterday or earlier in the week, and I want to introduce them to you. I'm delighted to be joined by retail consultant Eddie Shanahan, town planner and architect Brian Maher, who's an Abbey Leaks man, so he knows this territory very well, and garden designer Ingrid Smith. All three, you're very welcome to the programme, and as always, you've spent time. Brian, we'll start with you as the local man. You might just give us a sense of this town of Portlaoise, just a high level, so that we can appreciate its virtues.
Thanks, Bobby. Yeah, I mean, Portlaoise, I'm very proud to be here representing Avis and Young, and we put together a strategy for Portlaoise 2040 and beyond, so 2.5 years ago. It was finished in 2017. And it allowed us to kind of really speak to as many people as possible, to get involved with the town team as they are now, downtown Portlaoise as they were then. Leash County Council and John Mulholland was mentioned in particular earlier by Pat. I would have to say he started with a vision and he ended up with it on paper. And it has to be said that it is an incredibly important town. It's right at the nexus of the motorway network. It's in a prime location on the rail network. It's very central and it's very, very well served in terms of open countryside and beautiful places such as the Schlieff Blooms and all the rest. But it's also one of our fastest growing towns, a population of over 25,000 and heading into city territory at this
point. And that has doubled in the last 10 years,
it has,
that right?
Yeah.
So in terms of explosive growth, it's grown very quickly, which is good and bad, I'd suggest.
Well, it is, but I think it's fair to say that in Portlaoise 2040, we have looked at the fact that there is a deficit of certain things, such as greening, as you'll note, in the town centre. But there are elements of this strategy that are very much designed to bring forward those things. But yes, it is. It's having to catch up now.
Okay, and the important thing about any town is that it has a plan, and you've got that plan in front of you. So they're working collectively towards this plan.
Yes, I mean, I think to be fair, I've done this quite a few times in many towns around Ireland. There's something in the water here in terms of the collaborative effect that you get. It starts with the chief executive and it works its way, trickles its way out to everybody. We spoke to everybody, including the kids and Corlin and Og and everybody who was interested to come to public meetings and workshops. And it is very, it's so important that people engage in these process, because these plans are our future, and we are trying to put ourselves into 2040 to see where we need to
go. We'll come back to you in a second. I want to bring in Eddie Shanahan, retail consultant. Eddie, you walked the land from the old town, the new town, and the shopping centre, all three of them almost in parallel.
Well, I actually started just across the road from where we are here now, because I wanted to see what the Wine Buff had to offer.
Very important.
Important. But they had more to offer than I expected, because they have a sort of a subtitle, Grape and Bean. So I had a great coffee there. I had a brilliant chat with the owner, Tony Byrne. And the merchandising there, the selection of wines, the special promotions he does from time to time, made me realise that this town under promises and over delivers.
Okay, which is interesting. Let's drill down into that. Yeah. If you say it under promises, is that because people don't really know about what it
is? Well,
has to offer?
Always thought that Portlaoise was a long grey streak of granite, accented by rain. And to my great surprise, one of the first things that struck me was there's 45 minutes free parking.
Which is
and
a really good initiative.
And that is a piece of magic. And every town in Ireland should copy that, and well done to the local council. So then I started to stroll around the streets, and I went down Main Street and Bridge Street. And it could be forgiven for believing that three out of every four doors is a pub and the fourth one is a bookie shop on part of that. But things did get better. And there were some great examples of bright window displays and good merchandising. There was a brilliant little shop called Golden Stitches, which had a fantastic window display. Robert Redmond's Photo Lab, one window, one message, did what it said on the tin. There was Lillian Rose, a little fashion store. But the fashion offer seemed to be a bit one-dimensional. And then I wandered off in search of a little bit more excitement, and I went across towards that bunker-like facade on the other side of the roadway, and I discovered not just one, but two amazing shopping centres in there. Maybe even two and a half, if you like.
And can I ask you about that? The fact that those two and a half shopping centres were within the town, how impactful is that? That at least, you know, people might go to the shopping centre, or park there and walk across. In other words, that they're not 3 miles outside the town.
I think maybe if there was a bridge across, they might be more inclined. am I right? but that said, there's fantastic parking in there as well. There really is. There's a good selection of coffee shops. There are great iterations of all the major supermarkets. So everything you'd want, apart from, as I said, the one-dimensional fashion offer, seems to be here in this town.
Yeah.
Great interior shops. There was even a farmer's market. Now, when I arrived at it, it was looking a little jaded, but that was later in the day, so we'll forgive them for that. But there was a farmer's market here. So there's a lot to recommend it. The one thing that I would also compliment the council and the traders on is how clean it was. Although we have found a way to take chewing gum off the pavement, and it hasn't been discovered here locally yet.
Okay.
But that said, there was a lot going for it, except my bugbear is alive and well in Portlaoise. Service.
Not good in a few
appalling
places.
Appalling in many places. Yeah. Nobody said hello, with one or two exceptions. And when they did, it really elevated my experience. And as a consumer, in the age of sustainability, when customers are going to start buying less but buying better, retailers need to get smart at building new services and new engagements. And we'll go where we get those.
Okay, absolutely. Thank you for that, Eddie Shannon. Now, I want to also ask my old friend, garden designer, Ingrid Smith, who's also had a look at Portlaoise, and particularly its green areas and maybe green potential. Ingrid.
Hi, Bobby. How are you doing? For structure, I've got two examples of what impressed me and a couple of opportunities from a greening and a design perspective.
Okay, let's hear those.
So, of course, the obvious one is the park, which opened last June. I believe Brian was involved with that. Congratulations to everybody involved. It's the park of the Fort Protector in Fitzmaurice Place. Beautiful terrace, gorgeous materials. I know it wasn't cheap, but these things, to have a lasting life, you need to spend money on them. The planting was beautiful, the sculpture. As a civic space goes, I was really, really impressed.
Wow.
With that. Really, it's worth the visit. It really amazed me to come across it. And then I saw down the line that there is a plan for the old St. Peter's Church and Graveyard. That's a conservation project that's coming down the line as well. So that heartened me that there is something else that's coming down the line. And also, very obviously, a very, very active Tidy Towns committee. They were busy at it when I was there. There's lots of planting being done, like you said, Eddie. It's very, very clean.
The fact that the town doesn't have maybe a focal point, like there's no river, there's not, you know, like is it, does it have to work harder that there isn't something?
Well, there is a river.
Well, as in
the Treog River. Am I saying it right? The Treog River.
Yeah.
Brian, I believe there's a plan for a green.
There is. There's a blue way, which is basically a north-south link through the town centre, which is to open up access to the Treog, which was full of trout, I'm told, back in the day. It's seen better times, but it's very much focus of a new project to bring through the town.
You mentioned some opportunities, Ingrid. What were they?
It's the, I'm afraid it's the theme that comes up every time we do a town review. It's why are there cars on the main street?
Well, just about that, again, I was thinking about this. There's somebody, did you tell me, Brian, there was 4,500 car parking spaces?
3,500 spaces, yeah.
Which is a lot of car parking spaces for a town this size.
Yeah, and it does detract from the street.
And also, you know, Eddie's point about the 45 minutes free parking.
Yeah.
The fact that there are places to park is unusual, I'd suggest, when such an initiative is. So that must encourage, and given its location, there's probably a lot of people coming into Portlaoise by car. I would suggest that the car is pretty much essential, or close to essential.
Yeah, and it is a thorny issue, but your heavy shopping is going to be done in the outskirts or adjacent to the main street. That's where all your grocery shopping is being done. If I was walking on the main street, if there were no cars and there were no cars parked there, I could see a shop display.
Yeah, yeah. No.
I could sit down in a seating area unencumbered by the sight of cars adjacent to me. If you think about it, Grafton Street used to have cars on it.
That's right. Mm. 1978, they changed it, and we thought the world was going to end.
We thought the world was going to end. Yeah. It really
and
is
the
just
the thought of actually cars
that.
Being on it now.
Yeah, I think Portlaoise has the capacity to remove cars just from that stretch.
Yeah, definitely.
That would definitely improve the opportunities for greening and civic spaces.
Back to you, Eddie, then, in terms of, I suppose, the next chapter for Portlaoise, given what you've seen. And as you said, the combination of shopping centre, old town and new town, all providing a role. If the focus of customer service in particularly outlets was, if that bar was risen, this town would benefit immensely.
Yeah, I think this town has great potential, but that potential has to be built first on its people. On the retailers as well as the customers, on the environment, on the offer, and on the accessibility. And this town already does something very special. It brings together the modern iterations of retail alongside the ones we should never lose. And I'm going to mention one person and one outlet here. Al O'Donegan.
I was in it yesterday.
Tiny.
Great
it
shop.
Must be the smallest DIY
business.
Shop in Ireland, yeah. But it is the one with the biggest heart and the best selection of merchandise. And if you've lost a button from something or a screw from something, he has it. That's for sure. And the other place that really caught my eye, the best shop front in the entire place, is a small little pizza restaurant called Croft Alley. And it claims to be a wood-fired restaurant. And right beside it in the alleyway, a big stack of wood, and it caught my eye. It's outstanding. In any city in the world, that shop front would stand out for its simplicity and effectiveness.
Al O'Donegan's shop, he was telling me they're 90 years in business, and it used to be a bicycle shop in his grandfather's time. And again, wonderful to see shops being able to make trend. Like, that shop has probably seen 10 recessions, you know, and it's still there. Because it's got what the consumer, and they're able to change relative to the consumer demands. Okay, Brian, I'll just give a quick word to you before we go to a break. In terms of the next chapter for Portlaoise?
Well, I think it's already started in that through the strategy already there's been funding drawn down through the Urban Regeneration Development Fund. The first tranche, there was over 3.5 million taken down for specific interventions that were identified that included creating a cultural quarter and providing for people living in the town centre, because historically it was a very intensely occupied place, but over the years the town centre reduced down to about 600 people. We need to build that back up. So that's happening. There are lots of other, the low carbon initiative is already, the Blue Way strategy is already started. There's bus links coming through the town, which are being developed with the NTA. Lots more charging points, lots more cycling and walking, lots more linkages. And what we're hoping to do is move to a point where we can start getting over ourselves and our cars and start walking around the place.
All right. Okay. We're going to ask our panel, Eddie Shanahan, Brian Maher and Ingrid Smith, to stay with me here on the stage. I want to go to the audience now and talk to some of the local businesses that we have here. And I want to start with Jerry and Alison Brown from Jerry and Alison Brown Jewelers. You're very welcome to the programme. Firstly, I want to congratulate you on your winning the Retail Excellence Award and I was in your shop yesterday. It's a beautiful location and beautifully merchandised. So you're both very welcome to the programme. Jerry, tell us a little bit about the business, if you would.
Thank you, Bobby. We're in that store for the last 55 years, or second generation business.
Wow.
We took over the business in 85. So we've had seen a lot of changes, we've seen a few recessions, and we've come through by changing.
And what did you, what have you had to change, Gerry, in terms of, like, what is the consumer, how has a jeweller's shop changed the way you operate now than you did, say, 15 years ago?
Well, Bobby, our customers are much more sophisticated now. They're more travelled.
Yeah.
They see stores and they expect a certain standard to be kept. And that starts from how they see your shop from the outside, how it's curated inside, when they open the door, that they're welcomed, that you get a proper welcome, and that all your brands are relevant and up to the minute.
Yeah.
That's very important.
Alison, let's talk to you. You have another shop, is that right, on Lister Square?
That's right, Bobby.
Yeah, yes. So do you, how do you manage it between you, or do you just split the roles, or what do you do?
No, we have very clearly defined roles in the business. Gerry's front of house and looks after the retail and on the shop floor. And I'm up in the engine room where we look after...
Making sure the bills are paid.
Bills are paid, yeah. The customer focus is kept to the forefront of our business. We really do value customers king where Gerry Brown Jewellers is concerned. And we have a huge service industry with the repair side of the business.
Yeah, let me ask you about that. Again, you know, we seem to go through an age where we stopped repairing things. You know, it always kills me to see waste and see things being thrown out that are perfectly logical to repair. Yeah. How do you tell somebody, look, you should... It was there a problem with the cost of watches coming down so much that people said that they weren't actually worth repairing?
Well, that can be the case where a watch might have cost you €40 and it's cheaper buy another one than repair it. But with a lot of watches and jewellery, a lot of it is sentimental value.
Of course it is.
And that's the area that, like Gerry's a watchmaker, so he looks after the watches.
A horologist.
A horologist.
To give him his correct title.
And it's all in-house, and we have a stone setter and repair room in-house as well. And a lot of our business is the repair end, where people want to reinvent or polish, or sometimes they don't like the ring the way it looks now, and we can reset it and give it a whole new lease of life.
Yeah.
So we specialise in that. We value all the aspects of our business in both shops.
Fantastic.
And we have a great team who knows product knowledge. They've all done their jewellery courses. And we have found that Retail Excellence Ireland and Association of Fine Jewellers, we've learned so much nowadays that brought us up to the level where we need to be at.
Fantastic. You know, well, you're great ambassadors.
We have our website on now, jerrybrownjewellers.ie.
Go on, get that in.
And we're selling to all parts of the world, all parts of Ireland, but most particularly, you can click and collect. And so you can buy, if you're in Laois, stuck out in, you know, in work in Mount Rath, you can buy your product online and collect it in store.
Fantastic.
When you're in town at the weekend.
Isn't that great? So, and well done for a fantastic business, really changing with the times. That's been there so many years. A big round of applause for Gerry and Alison Brown. Now, I always like to talk to the property person in the town. I'm delighted to welcome to the show Clement Herron. He's a Donegal man, but his business is very much here in Port Laois. Clement, tell us about the marketplace here for buying and selling houses in Port Laois.
The market's improving steadily at the minute, and we're very busy with new homes and new offerings. And we're probably offering really good value for money. A new A-rated three-bedroom semi would be typically 260,000 across the road from us on the Dublin side of town. And as you go east, every kilometre you go, you're adding €1,000 to your price.
Is that how it works? So,
well, it's not exactly how it works.
Does that mean that every kilometre you go west, you're adding 20 minutes to your commute? Is that another way of saying that?
No, because you got to be careful there, because you have the M7 and you have the M8. So if you take, for example, Monaster Evan, is a town that's 10 minutes from here. And if you go to Monaster Evan, you're going to pay 15,000-20,000 more for your house. So if you come back to Port Laois, it's a big town, close to city standard, and it has everything in it. It has the junction, it has the train station, it has the theatres, the pubs, it has the shopping centres, it has big town living and an urban centre. And as you go east to Kildare or to Monaster Evan or even Naas, you don't get the same value for money because you don't have the same quality of life. So with the Chamber and what's happening in Port Laoise now, they're promoting, we're trying to bring business to the town and the houses will follow. We were very dependent, and I was very dependent, on commuters to Dublin. There's 12,000 people leave this county every day to work. So we're trying to bring the business back into town, give people a better quality of life and offer them a home. 120 euro a square foot, I can sell you a house, a brand new house, 20 minutes west of here.
Yeah.
And that's a third of the price for the same size of house that you'll find in the south part of Dublin.
So who's buying these houses, Clement, when you say that? And I know, you know, obviously you want business in the town, you want people, people obviously would like to work and live near their business, but the reality is, are people from Dublin buying the houses?
Yeah, that's the reality.
That is the reality.
That is the reality. We'll say the guard based in Dublin, flexible hours, he can get into town fairly handy. He's buying his three-bedroom semi. You have the nurse, you have the school teacher. But locals and local people coming to work in Port Laoise, I find, are buying new houses now and happy to pay the extra money for an A-rated new house. You'll get a second-hand three-bedroom semi for 195,000 and you'll pay 60 or 70,000 more for a new A-rated home. You get your 5% back.
Okay.
They're doing their maths. And the market is for the first... I'd say the last 2 weeks, closing have been fantastic, bookings have been fantastic. You know, it's very buoyant, but prices will go up very quickly because you're just starting to just get over the cost of production.
Okay.
I'm selling houses, like a second-hand house, you cannot produce a three-bedroom semi for 195,000. At 260,000, if you do the maths, you get back to VAT, you have cost of production, service the site, there's no money in it for a builder.
Okay, we'll come back to that. Let me talk to PJ Kavanagh from PJ Kavanagh's Main Street Port Laoise, a great music venue, a comedy venue. Still living over the shop with the wife and kids. Is that right, PJ?
Absolutely, yeah.
Tell us about the business. It sounds great. I passed it again yesterday and I just looked inside the door.
You didn't call in, though.
I did. I put my head in the door. there was too many people in it. And this is at 5 o'clock.
I'm the fifth generation in the pub. We're living, myself, my wife, my two kids. We live upstairs over it. There's a bar on ground floor level, a venue first floor level, and a venue in the courtyard as well.
So, how's business?
That's pretty good, yeah. Yeah. We've lots of stuff going on the whole time. We've a good few gigs in the last few weeks. We had Tommy Tiernan down. We had David O'Doherty last week. We've a good few different bits and pieces coming up over the next few weeks as well.
And I presume you have to work very hard at, you know, at getting talent, at putting on different things, trying out new things around the entertainment side of it. Is that a big challenge?
Absolutely, yeah. We started the comedy about 18 years ago, and the first group we had was the first night of comedy was with a group called Flight of the Conchords, who've gone on to perform in the Three Arena, I think two or three times, and they're huge in the States. I think that was in a room that held 60 people. We thought we'd fallen onto the magic recipe of how to succeed in the comedy world. And 2 weeks later, we had the second comedy gig and there was three people at it.
There you go. The ups and downs of comedy.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining us, PJ, and good luck with the business.
Thanks.
Great stuff you're doing there. Brian, I'm going to give you the last word. We've heard from three exemplary retailers and hospitality operators, and indeed Clement giving us the wherewithal on the price, the house of houses even.
Well, I think it has to be said that going back to this whole business of collaboration, the team is key, and I think you have the team. We might not win all Ireland's, but we might be might end up having the best town in Ireland.
All right. I want to thank my guests, Eddie Shanahan, Brian Maher, and Ingrid Smith. Again, I really appreciate what you do for us. You really do put your heart and soul into, and you always see the positives in towns, which we greatly appreciate. So thank you again for that. We're broadcasting from the Collection Hotel in Port Laoise for your town, your Main Street, and we're here at the Main Registry. That's home of .ie. Loads more to come in the next hour. I'll be talking to the MD of Laoise Hire, why Laoise is becoming the glamping capital of Ireland. And I was going to bring you a special treat of me making jam out Nabby Leaks, but I'm keeping it till next week, just so that Leash will be featured on the show 2 weeks. And I want to thank Helen G and all she's done for Leash. She gave me also Meet the Makers, a whole folder of food producers yesterday in Port Leash, and I was amazed at the talent that there is here. So food talent as well as everything else. We still have a live audience here. I just wanted to see if they've survived the first hour. Are they still here? Yes. Thank God for that. No, it's great that you're still here, and thank you for listening, and thank you for coming out in such huge numbers today. Just to say, I'm also open on Twitter, Abby, at Bobby Kerr, and the hashtag BobbyBizPortLeash, if you'd like to use that. So we were talking to some local businesses before the break. I want to talk now to some more businesses. Another shop that I called into yesterday is the Nook and Cranny Gift Shop, and also The Pantry, which is a separate business but owned by LaDonna McCartan. LaDonna, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much indeed, Bobby. It's actually owned by myself and my partner, Mark, so I had better give him a mention, as he does half of the work.
and Mark, as I understand it, runs The Pantry. And you run the gift shop. Is that how you divide the territory, so to speak?
We do. It gives us plenty to talk about when we come home in the evening, yes.
Now, am I right in saying that the pantry was the first part of the group and then the gift shop, which came first?
Correct. That's exactly right. About 7 years ago, Mark and I actually took a four-month trip away around the world, and when we were away, we had changed direction in our careers. Mark's an accountant, and my background is in hotel sales. And I suppose one of the things that we decided when we were away, we decided two things, in fact. One was that we both wanted to have a business of our own, and the second thing was that we wanted to come home and work in Ireland. And so we came back, and we have family in Port Leash, and we decided to come back and work in Port Leash.
And were you from the town?
Mark's from the town, okay. Yes, yeah, yeah. So I'm a blow-in, actually, from County Meath, but a very happy blow-in, yeah. And I have to say, very settled and very happy, both in our business and in the community in Port Leash. So we used to frequent a little cafe called The Pantry, actually, at the time. And when we came back from New Zealand, we discovered that the pantry was for sale. So we bought the business. It was then a 33-seater cafe, and we extended it very quickly after buying it. We've actually extended it three times since. We've added on a lovely walled garden, which is a nice addition in a town
centre. I was in it yesterday. It's a fabulous shop.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much indeed. You'll have to come back when the summer is in bloom, when Port Leash Tidy Towns has done its absolute magic with the main street, and you'll see the lovely hanging baskets and our walled garden in all its glory. So a year and a half into having bought the cafe, and we had extended it at that time, as I say, we decided to open another business just a little bit further down the main street, and then Nook and Cranny was born. So it's a gift shop.
Yeah.
And then a little while later after that, I don't know, brave or mad, we decided to also buy a small artisan business, a soap making business. So we actually also make our own handcrafted soaps and bath bombs, which we sell
and sell them through the shop.
Well.
Yeah. And how many years has all this been going on then, from start to finish?
We have the pantry now for 6 years, and Nook and Cranny is 4 years old. Yeah, yeah. We employ 15 people locally in the town now as well.
And tell me then, just finally, what's it like doing business on that street, that premier street in Port Leash?
Well, do you know, I have to say we absolutely love it. There's a wonderful atmosphere, both from the traders on the street. One of the, as I say, as a blow-in, one of the first things that I was very struck by when I arrived to Port Leash was the solidarity among traders. On the first day that we opened the pantry, four local businesses, I don't think we had the doors opened half an hour, and four local businesses made it their business to come and say hello and welcome. Obviously, being in a cafe, it gives you a wonderful opportunity to meet people as well, which is great as a newcomer to a town. And I'm delighted to say that we have we've lots of friends and a really good social community. And I have to say too, one of the other things that is wonderful is I have a 1 kilometre commute.
There you go.
And 10 minutes on the other side, I'm able to go up to the Sleeve Blooms and clear my head and have a walk in the most beautiful scenery, or out to Emo Court. It's just a wonderful place to live and a super place to do business.
Thanks, LaDonna, because you're a great ambassador for Portlaoise and for retail, and indeed the pantry as well in Portlaoise. I want to talk now about glamping, because glamping under the stars, Ciara Fingleton is here. That's her business. Ciara, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Bobby.
Now, tell us, very interesting, glamping under the stars. We're talking shepherds, huts, tents. What's the gig here? Tell us about the business.
Okay. Well, we started about 4 years ago, and we're just about 10 minutes outside Portlaoise. As you say, we've got a shepherd's hut, two wood lodges, and three bell tents. And our season runs from the beginning of April to the end of September. And during that time, we welcome a lot of families with small children especially, a lot of them coming down from Dublin. And then we also have hen parties and birthday parties, so adult parties.
Ne'er the twain mix, though.
Absolutely not. Absolutely. Yeah, if you're coming on an adult party, you have to book the whole place out. So you get exclusive use of the place.
And the last thing you want is to be there in the middle of a hen party. I can tell you that.
Oh, absolutely. Well,
get a weekend break away from the family.
That's absolutely right.
So you don't allow that happen.
No, we don't. We make sure that does never happens. But exactly what a few other people have said, Portlaoise is a brilliant central location for people to come and meet. So we quite often get, as I say, hen parties come to us because it's not too far from Dublin, it's not too far from Cork, and they can all meet in the middle. And as well, extended family groups will come and book out six of our units, and they'll have the whole place to themselves. So, you know, friends and family will come and meet and book out the place. And it's just a great chance to get away from the city and enjoy campfires and stars and relax.
Well, great. It sounds like a great business, a very interesting business. Good luck to you, Ciara, and thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Now, well done to Ciara. Now, I want to talk to Stephen Hudson. He's the territory manager for Portlaoise Tullamore at Permanent TSB, but he's very involved in business here in the town. Stephen, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hello, Bobby. Thanks for having us on.
Now, you've heard a lot this morning here, Stephen, so I'd like your thoughts, because I know you've run the local chapter here of the BNI. You've been involved in the movement to get business going here in the town of Portlaoise. So you've heard a lot of people, you've heard the town team. What are your thoughts?
Some great success stories there, I suppose, as we've heard across the way. And I suppose a lot of the businesses that you've spoken to this morning have been around for a long time through good times and bad times. At the moment, there's Portlaoise is a really exciting place to be. There's a great business community, and there's a great community within the town that I suppose we're all pulling for each other and supporting each other. And it's great to see the likes of Pat McDonough, come into town and see the potential that Portlaoise has, because we've been shouting it for years.
Yeah, am I right in saying that there was no Chamber of Commerce in Portlaoise for a number of years? But that was probably substituted by your BNI chapter.
Correct. I suppose the BNI is a group of about 25 people there at the moment that come together to support each other and I suppose generate business for one another.
Yeah, I know the concept where you have one plumber, one solicitor, and again, everybody brings opportunities to every other discipline.
Correct. And I suppose networking, when the BNI started in Laois, networking probably wasn't, people hadn't opened up their minds to the power of networking. And certainly through the BNI, we're able to do that and certainly, I suppose, develop business for each other by opening up our own network of contacts to each other.
And then what about then the Chamber of Commerce and its position now in the town? Is it been well supported?
Chamber of Commerce has been massively supported, and I suppose thanks to Bernie, she's doing massive work on the ground here. We had the recent jobs fair that brought in 2,500 people through the door. You had sort of 40 businesses promoting jobs, high-end jobs that were available in the town. So really, really positive stuff happening in the town.
Well, excellent, and thank you for joining us, Steve. Stephen. Stephen Hudson there, Territory Manager for Portlaoise Tullamore at Permanent TSB. Now, I'm delighted to be joined by four young people that I want to say hello to. They're part of a music generation in Laois, and they sent me along a song, and they're mad, and they're great. And hello to Tygo Dwyer, Ellen Rowney, Lloyd McCarthy, and Anna Kelly. Welcome. How are you all?
We're going great, thank you.
Tell us about this song. I hear it's crazy.
Yeah, we were just in the recording studio there after Christmas. We recorded two of our original songs, Movie Star Girl and All I Want to Do Is Dance. It was a great experience.
Great. And who does what in this group?
Well, I'm lead guitarist and backing vocals.
I'm the lead singer and guitar.
I do drums. I play bass.
All right, well, have a listen to this, folks. This is this band. They're magnificent, and they're from Portlaoise. Have a listen to them.
The colours of the dance floor light up my eyes. My heart starts to race, my blood starts to rise. This feeling inside when my feet start to move, like the whole world stops for a while.
It's all happening here in Laois. Now, my next guest is an old friend of the show. He's Kevin O'Loughlin. He's the chief executive of Nostra, and he joins me now to talk about his global IT business, bringing it back to his home county in the newly created Webmill Digital Hub in nearby Mount Malik. Kevin, you're very welcome, and good to see you as always.
Thanks, how are you? Good to see you as well. I'm great. Yeah.
Now, you're a Rosenallis man, is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, and you grew up in a pub. Your father was in the meat business, but you're... And am I right in saying you're associated with the hotel that was in the town as well?
Yeah, so the hotel was owned by family. Uncle Declan had the hotel here in Portlaoise. And we grew up Rosenallis. We sold the pub in 1994, but I have fond memories of collecting glasses and all that fun stuff during the 1990 goal score in the World Cup.
Yeah,
I remember making cocktail sausages in the bar at 11 o'clock at night and handing them out. So yeah.
where the real trade is learned, isn't it?
Exactly.
You learn
exactly.
About customer service there. I can tell you.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Tell us then. You worked in IT. You branched out on your own with your brother and a couple of partners. Tell us about the business.
Yeah, so Nostra started in 2007, and we were very early adopters to cloud technology. So we kind of saw it probably before everyone else, and we got in 2 years too early or 3 years too early. So we had a tough couple of years. What we thought was obvious, other people didn't. So we started Gary Byrne, Senan Fanouk, and myself and Barry back in 07. In probably 13, we started getting good traction. We won a customer called Avalon Aerospace, the aircraft leasing firm, and they went global, and we kind of followed them. And we ended up setting up, you know, right across the world, Hong Kong and New York and Florida. Today, we probably have customers in 16 or 18 countries globally. And the reality is, and the reason I'm here today, is that we've just opened up in Mount Melick, and it doesn't matter where our people are, we can support anyone, anywhere.
So essentially you provide an IT services for companies right across the world, and I presume that service can be as small as getting a laptop for a guy, or looking after his mainframes or whatever else is involved.
Absolutely.
The whole span.
Absolutely, yeah. We consider ourselves the IT department of our customers. So, like Boyle Sports are a client of ours. We look after all the retail units nationwide. You know, we'd look after Dawn Farm Foods, the Queeley Group. You know, and what we do ultimately is, I can't get into my email, I can't print, right through to setting up servers and say mainframes, which don't exist anymore.
We'll
let you away with that.
That's my knowledge of the sector. But that's okay. But tell us then about this initiative out in Mount Malik. So you're a Dublin-based company, but you think that basically the geography of Portlaoise is probably important, is it?
It is,
in terms of being located here.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, for us, you know, our guys work all over the place. In fact, I was in Mount Melek 2 weeks ago, and the team there were working on a site in Johannesburg, right? So, you know, they can be located anywhere. So for us, it's about getting people and getting the right people. And in Dublin, it's a very difficult market to recruit. And when you recruit people, they have all sorts of housing challenges, which I know we mentioned at the start of the show. And, you know, we're trying to encourage people potentially to move down to Laois and take a Dublin salary in a Laois office, effectively, but also to try and, you know, take some of the people who are commuting up. And then once we get to a certain scale down here, probably 15 or 20 people, then we can start a graduate program and start bringing people up in our own system.
Do you, like, when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, if you're looking at employees, looking at high-skilled tech employees such as yourselves, the trade-off for quality of life, you know, to be able to own your own home, to be able to walk the fields, to be able to, versus, you know, that commute to Dublin where you're paying an extortionate cost either to rent or buy.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot to be said to working outside of the greater Dublin area.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, even in the last few years, we've seen a huge change in how people operate. You know, like, people can literally, in our industry and lots of industries, they can work from anywhere. They can work from a Starbucks as well as they can work somewhere else. So having them...
You got me back.
Insomnia. But you know, somebody spending 2 hours a day in a car is 2 hours a waste of time, you know, in what we do. And more and more jobs we're seeing are moving like that. So this, for us, is as much a test to see how well we can manage the culture of a remote working office.
Yeah, and it's great to see a Laois man again reinvesting in his own county. So well done for that. And I'm sure the people of Laois are very grateful that companies such as yourselves, international companies, are taking that sort of step. So big round of applause for Kevin O'Loughlin. Now, after the break, I'm going to be talking to Tom Parlin from the Construction Industry Federation. He's a Laois Offaly man. We'll debate his credentials when he comes up on stage. And I'm also going to be talking to the Governor of Port Laois Prison, John Farrell. My next guest is Tom Parlin. He's the Director General of the Construction Industry Federation. But before joining the CIF, he served as a TD for Laois Offaly and as a Minister for State in the 2002 to 2007. Tom Parlin, formerly President of the Irish Farmers Association, the IFA, and to prove that there is life after politics, he's here with us in studio this morning. You're very welcome, Tom.
Thanks, Bobby.
How are you?
Very good.
Now, you're a Cooldairy County Offaly man, but as you said yourself, this is Parlin country. All those years ago.
Well, it was for a short while, anyway. Yeah.
You said that you were when you were elected in politics, you were elected here in Port Laois, and when you lost your seat, it was in your hometown or your near town of Parlin, County Offaly.
That's right.
Is that the irony of Laois Offaly?
The count when I was elected was down in St Mary's Hall. And then when I got unelected, it was in the Marion Hall in Burr. But look, it was a great time, and I had a wonderful time at politics. Yeah. I went straight in and went straight out, enjoyed it very much, great honour. And it gives me massive respect for all of the people who vote. You know, when you put your name up on the poster and you go out knocking on doors, it's wonderful for democracy, shows people have balls and guts and want to do something, whatever they believe in. There's people that went out and got 100 votes for some wacky sort of a notion, but they believed in it and they put it before the people. So.
And you're right, it's very easy to take a shot at somebody who puts themselves out
and
there.
And I don't mean you personally, an awful lot of the commentators like to have cheap shots at politicians.
Yeah.
And it is an easy shot. And now we see all the stuff that's coming out on social media and all the bullying and all the nasty stuff that they are very exposed to. So, you know, if we don't attract good people into politics, it'll be our loss.
I totally agree with you. And again, you know, the slog of canvassing and the work that's required to get elected, and then you're in a very short-term job. It's, as you say, it's very easy to be unelected, and to be prepared for life after it obviously doesn't work out for everybody.
That's true. And the strange thing that I didn't appreciate and still don't understand, we've just seen recently that there was a massive push all over the country for Sinn Féin, that nobody, even some of the most seasoned full-time professional commentators,
that's right,
commented 1 and 2 days before the election saying they reckon Sinn Féin were going to lose a few seats. And, you know, the opposite happened. When I got elected, the PDs only had 2 seats and they weren't expected to make any showing, but there was a massive showing, and I benefited from that. I thought I was immune to the opposite.
Yeah.
But they said the tide went out in 2007 for the PDs, and it took me out with it. And regardless of whether I thought I was different or not, I just went out with the tide.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what's after happening to some of the parties that fared badly now. So it's an odd thing that such a wave hits a whole mass of people.
And I think just to close out on it, we've got 60 new odd TDs, all who are there for the first time and aren't there only that they want to make a difference.
Of course.
Like, so I think, again, it's...
Yesterday morning. I was passing through there going to a meeting, and I'd like to be in on the first day, just, and, like, it's great to see the pride of the people themselves and their families that are there for the first day. It is a wonderful honour. And, you know, they may only be there for a short time, as you say.
Tom, can I ask you now, you're Director General of the Construction Industry Federation. Where are we at now on the house building? I'm hearing reports that, you know, that the supply-demand equation seems to be getting into a better balance. What's the current state of play with houses and house building?
Well, I suppose the fact is, last year we built 21,000 houses, 21,600 new houses. About a third of those were one-offs. Those are people who would build them for themselves.
Is there that many of those?
Yeah, and that's around the country. And if you look at the local papers now, and I throw an eye over my own local papers, you know, there's nearly a page full of applications now for people building one-off houses.
Right.
And clearly there's people in Dublin still that might be knocking a house and rebuilding or in any of the towns. But I think the big deficit is the social housing. And the other big problem is, which traditionally, you know, couples, you know, in normal jobs could afford to get a mortgage and build a house or buy a house, and that's scarcely possible now. In Dublin, you need to be collectively earning over 90,000 before you qualify for a mortgage. That's crazy money. And down the country, you know, you're talking about probably 40,000 each between two people. So, you know, it's the bar has risen very high.
You heard Clement earlier there outlining the state of play of houses in a town like Portlaoise, where there's 11,000 people leaving the county every day to go to Dublin, and the people buying the houses primarily are from Dublin.
Yeah.
That doesn't augur very well for the future, does it?
No, and for the industry that I represent, like, a big part of it is about balanced regional development. Like, Dublin is top-heavy. I work and commute in and out of Dublin every day. It's crazy. The amount of time lost, the amount of frustration and so on is mad. But one of the issues, and I know housing, thankfully for me and the industry I represent, for number one item in terms of the election. And, you know, everyone is, you know, outdoing each other with the ambition to have to build more houses. But one of the big issues is that the actual build cost, if you hire any builder, be from Portlaoise or wherever here, to build a house, 46% only of the end price is the actual cost of building the house.
And so the rest is going to the government?
So, well, there's the site, of course, which is a factor, and there's a big issue whether it's in Dublin or Portlaoise. That's the big advantage Portlaoise and the country have. Sites are cheaper here. But other than that, the VAT, the development levies, you got to pay your water rate up front, £5,600 you got to pay before you get a water connection. And you could be waiting for 6 months to get that connection then after that.
So just finally, Tom, then, in your view, you've been very close to this. You hear a lot of people commenting about it. But do you think, have we turned the corner in terms of supply and demand on housing?
Well, certainly we're going to build more houses this year than last year. I'd say conservatively we should do about 25,000. But we obviously need more than that. So we have a lot of contact with, you know, politicians and with policymakers. And to any new housing minister, whoever it is, they need to be tough. They need to challenge a lot of the stuff that's holding up house building.
Right.
The delays in planning are absolutely crazy. There was mention made earlier this morning about legal reviews, or, you know, where people can challenge the constitutionality of a decision. It's just a means of blackmailing or blocking a particular project
and prolonging the process.
So a new minister will have the right, will have the power to make legislation to make that not as simple. Like, you don't even have to put any money down by going to court to have a judicial review. And likewise, some of the other, there's impediments there that a new minister can say, you know, let's get those out of the system, even if we do need some emergency legislation to get over the problem we have over the next few years. So a strong government that's determined, I think we'll see a lot of houses built.
All right. Tom Parlan, honorary Offaly man here in Laois this morning. Thanks for joining us. Now, if you ask people to name one thing about Portlaoise, there's a good chance that they'll mention either the hospital or the prison, two institutions that have played a huge role in the town and indeed the nation's life. I'm delighted to say that I'm joined now with the governor of Portlaoise Prison, Mr. John Farrell. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Bobby.
How are you?
Thank you. Good, thank you.
Just you might tell us, John, how did you end up as the governor of Portlaoise Prison? What was your route to that job? It's not a job that I'm terribly familiar with.
It's a long story. I joined the prison service in 1991 after the recession of the 80s, looking for a job. So from there, spent 18 years in Mountjoy Prison. Woke up to including the Royal Chief Officer, moved on to Clover Hill as assistant governor, Wheatfield as deputy governor. And then moved to the Governor One post in operations in IPS HQ. And in June 2018, the prison service asked me to move down to Portlaoise, so I've been there since.
Can I ask you, is it a stressful job?
It can be. Depends, the stress impact, I think, depends on the individual. I think I've been lucky that I haven't been overly stressed by it, even though I've been through all the turmoils that I can throw at you. It is stressful for some people, and we have supports there to deal with that if we have
to. I know for security reasons that there's a lot of things we can't talk about, but can you give us a sense of what prison life is like for an inmate?
Initially, it's traumatic, obviously. Anybody going in for the first time, it's a removal from normal society. To look at the higher end of the scale, people that go in for a life sentence literally go to court and don't go home again.
Yeah.
So the prison service and the community in prison becomes their family. Essentially, the prison service is a people-led organisation. So we've about 4,000 staff in overall the country, 300 in Portlaoise. So essentially, we're people looking after the people in a secure environment. The regime or the routine in prison is quite regimented. It's set times, and that's for.
And are you allowed work, or do you have to work, or how does?
You are allowed work, and we encourage work and training. Work training education is a big part of the prison regime, as well as rehabilitation. Forms a huge part. We encourage it. We can facilitate the whole population, unfortunately. So we have regime management plans that rotate access to education and services for prisoners.
And again, without getting into too much detail, but you've got to be very cognizant of, I suppose, groups outside the prison, and
yes.
How do you decide who goes where, and you know, and all that sort of factioning and gangland stuff.
It's a huge issue and becoming more difficult. So we have certain courts commit to certain prisons. Portlaoise here is the only one that accepts commitments from the Special Criminal Court.
Right.
But we also accept transfers from other prisons. So all the transfers and movements of prisoners are coordinated by Operations Directorate in Longford, and they're all on foot of ministerial order. So we do plan moves, and we assess risk when we're moving somebody, and we assess affiliations and conflicts, etc., etc. So we do manage populations quite carefully.
Can I ask you then about the impact that a prison has on a town like Portlaoise? It must provide a lot of jobs. There must be a lot of, I suppose, money spent locally as a result of it, for whatever reason. So.
There's a huge amount of tradition in Portlaoise in particular. It's been here since 1830. Some of the businesses here, you know, for 90 years. We're here for 170 years. So Portlaoise, about 300 staff, working on a three roster pattern between Portlaoise Midlands Prison and the Prison Service College. There's about 800 staff in the area.
It's a lot of people.
Most of them are Leash residents or the adjoining counties. Portlaoise Prison itself puts in a small amount into the local economy, about £200,000 a year or euro a year through local contracts, but the footfall for staff having lunch and making purchases and doing shopping is also huge, so it's a huge contributor to the local economy in that sense.
Yeah, so you say a lot of the prison officers are local people, and is there a tradition of father, son, that type of?
Father, son, grandfather, grandmother.
Yeah, that's our prison families.
Prison families, our own assistant governor, his father was a former governor, so we have that tradition. We have, I think, three sets of brothers in Midlands Prison, a couple in Portlaoise. So it's one of the areas in the country that's very traditionally built around the prison
environment. Yeah, that's very interesting. As a governor of a prison, I'm sure you deal with some pretty serious people, prisoners and that.
Yes.
Do you think it makes you pessimistic about human nature? Or
no.
Or do you just have to be beyond that?
You have to be beyond it and take people at face value. We can't judge. People in prison have been judged in the courts and sent to us for confinement and rehabilitation. So you've got to engage with people at a personal level. most of the people in prison are brothers, sisters, fathers. So they are not behind the crime to the person. So on that basis, that's the basis we engage with them on. So no, we can't, you can't prejudge or post-judge a person on what they do or don't do. We take them on face value. If they're respectful, they're given respect back, etc. So we have huge programs to deal with those issues. Most of the people we have been taken advantage of in some way, shape or form during their life, and it's getting over that initial distrust is the first hurdle we face, and we do it quite well.
I just wanted to ask you, finally, I suppose, I noticed on your LinkedIn page that you're trained in hostage negotiation.
Formerly I was, yes.
Tell me about that.
It's something, thankfully, we don't use often, but we have to have contingencies for it. I trained, I think, back in the late 90s, shortly after the crisis in Mountjoy in 97. We put in a formal programme. I was one of, I think, 26 or 27. I can't now negotiate, obviously, at the level I'm at, so we have a team of negotiators below governor level. Similar to the Garda programme, any hostage negotiation programme in any service across the world, there's a negotiator level and then decision-maker level. And we have three levels in that. So
it's about listening rather than talking and all that psychology.
It's about listening and talking very carefully.
Carefully. Well, very interesting. And finally, can I ask you, what do you do to switch off? How do you relax from the busy job of governor?
I study, unfortunately. I read. I was playing sport until I got injured about a year ago, so I play a bit of golf. Played rugby up to about 8 years ago.
Great.
So I'm active as I can outside of work. Family's a big issue. And I'm from a coaching background, so I decompress with the management team regularly over coffee.
Good man. Well, listen, what a pleasure to meet you. John Farrell, Governor of the Portlaoise Prison.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now you're most welcome back to the programme. Bobby here from the Collection Hotel in Portlaoise for your town, your main street, proudly sponsored by IE Domain Registry. Now, it's the Executive Chair. I'm delighted to welcome to the Executive Chair. He's a Laois man. He's Michael Killeen. He's the Managing Director of Laois Hire Group and HSS Hire Group Ireland. Michael, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Bobby.
Now, as a Laois man, Michael, you grew up in Portlaoise, is that right?
Yep.
And your father was in the plant hire business.
My father was in the heavy plant hire business, yeah. He came from Galway originally, a little village down Tina, County Galway. And he moved up to Portlaoise and set up a plant hire land reclamation business.
So was that something you were always going to do? Or?
It was, yeah. We were machinery mad from kids, and we graduated into that then in due course, yeah. It was always in the blood.
So, and with that in mind, you were shipped off to Cistercian College, Ross Gray. Then you went to IT Carlo to get the certificate or whatever it was in business.
Yeah.
And off you went.
Yeah, I did a term in CCR Ross Gray. I was actually in the CBS in Portlaoise. And I went to the secondary school. I came home on Friday evening and it was announced that I was being dropped into CCR on Ross Gray on Monday morning.
So on don't Sunday, want to get too much notice on
Sunday, my father dropped me in this massive hallway in a big stone building, and a Cistercian monk came that way and he went that way. Five years later, I was out, so free. So that was my education to start with.
And speaking of prisons, because I know when we had the governor on, John Farrell, earlier, your first break as a business was landing a prison contract. Tell me about that.
So we established Laois Hire in 1992, myself and my wife Maureen, from scratch. And we worked our way up brick by brick, you know. We got our first big break, funny enough, in the Midlands prison in 1998. It was a 60 million contract, the biggest ever to come to Portlaoise. And Langer Oak were the contractors, and we managed to negotiate a deal with them to supply the prison, to supply them on the prison contract for 3 years, and that was a massive contract for us. It was 24/7. We supplied everything to that contract from start to finish, and it really put us on the map.
How have things changed, Michael, in the equipment or plant hire business? Like, when somebody goes to a site, are they likely, or in some cases, do they rent everything? Is that a model that they use?
It's a mixture, I suppose, Bobby. And, you know, recession had an effect on that as well. You know, contractors pre-recession, some of them owned their own kit. After the recession, a lot of them went to hiring a kit.
Yeah.
A lot of the contractors will hire a kit now because they don't want to manage it. And you've got the health and safety issues now. You've got the maintenance on the kit. You've got all the whole eco thing now. And, you know, there's a big swing towards, you know, lower emissions and all that sort of stuff. So it's massive investment.
Yeah.
So contractors now they're very much inclined to swing towards, can you supply everything on for our project?
And how do you decide what sort of lines of equipment that you rent out? What's the process there?
It's very, I always describe it very like fashion, really. So it changes, you know, nearly yearly. So, you know, for a 3-year span, construction companies might want a certain type of powered access, a certain type of machine, you know, or different types of equipment. But it sort of advances every year.
Right.
And things change. So, but the hard core of the kit is, you know, it's everything from the start of the site, the setup to the site, to the finish of the site. So we'll supply everything from the welfare units, that's the offices, everything got to do with welfare, right up to concrete and generation, powered access, right through to finish the site, to the fit out inside.
That's amazing. Mm. And when you buy a Kango hammer, for instance, just to simplify things, do you say, this Kango hammer has cost me X, I now have to rent that 5 times before it's paid for?
Well, there's a rule of thumb, really, you know. So small equipment, you know, it's got to pay for itself within a 12-month period. Because after that, it becomes nearly disposable. And larger equipment, there's probably a four-year lifespan on it, you know.
Okay.
Well, 4 year, it's got to pay for itself within 4 years.
So if you're buying a big piece of plant, you know, that you're going to write off over 4 years, you have to be fairly sure that you're buying the right thing, that it's a product people will want to rent.
It'll be product that's in demand. So, you know, basically it's, you know, nearly all the construction companies across the board, they're going to require the same type of kit. So most of the construction jobs will require a product or a category. So we try to keep those categories common.
Yeah, no, that's very, very interesting. And in terms of Portlaoise then, as a location, if you're working on construction sites up and down the country, it's probably geographically a good place to be.
That's one thing we found, and that's what sort of really got us established, you know, the way we are now, how we expanded our network. Portlaoise was, you know, I suppose we were lucky to an extent that we were in Portlaoise and we saw the opportunity to set up in Portlaoise. But Portlaoise is a kind of a hub for everywhere. We can hit Galway in an hour and sort of 40 minutes in a truck. We can hit Cork in less than 2 hours. We can hit Dublin in an hour and a quarter. Before, you couldn't do that, really. So that's the one great thing about Portlaoise that we find for our business. We can dispatch trucks at 6 o'clock in the morning and they can be on sites anywhere at 8 o'clock.
And how many people are you employing, Michael?
120 and in the Portlaoise depot, the Portlaoise organisation.
Is it easy to get staff?
No, it's quite difficult now. Obviously, in the current situation, you know, good, you know, experienced staff and trained staff are getting harder and harder to get. Some of the reason for that in our game is that there was no apprentices trained during the recession period.
Yeah.
We're trying to encourage that now, obviously. So we're finding out we have to go to places like Croatia to get fitters and drivers and that sort of thing, you know, which is kind of, that's what it is. But it's a good thing, I suppose, in a way, because employment is you know, as low as it ever was now, really.
You're a great community man, Michael. Can you tell me about the KN Group and your investment in rally driving and sponsorship there?
Well, we kind of got into that by default, in a way. I got to know Donna Kelly, the Kelly family. Donna is the CEO of KN Networks. You know, I'm sure everybody sees the brands around the country everywhere. And I got to know Donna, I suppose, 5-6 years ago. We do business together. And Donna was big into the rallying, so he kind of sucked me into it a bit. And so we sponsored the team. So it's actually the Laois Hire Rally team now. And so Donna and his son, Eamon, who's only 21, they've got 3 very, very expensive cars. And they do all the big rallies in Ireland, and they expect to win a few of them this year. It's a very dangerous sport, as we all know, but it's a really interesting sport. And, you know, we find it's really good for, you know, customer, corporate, etc. And it's great, yeah.
Well, you have a great business, and again, you've seen the highs and lows of the building trade, and still standing and very prosperous. Michael Killeen of Laois Hire. Thank you very much. Now I want to welcome James O'Connor. He's our musician. James, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Bobby.
Thanks you're an emerging singer-songwriter, and you have a residency in Caithness here in the town, so that's proof of your credentials.
That's where I started. Still playing there.
Tell us a little bit more about yourself, if you would, James.
I've been writing songs for about 20 years. I teach guitar, teach ukulele. I work with Music Generation in Laois here. I'm been known as the spiritual leader of Paper Planes.
Good for man, some reason. And we heard them earlier, and they were...
So I'm not doing too bad so far.
Fair play to you, because it must be great working with kids that are interested in music, is
it? Absolutely, you know, it's great to see them progressing, you know, learning an instrument from scratch, keeps them away from the Xbox and all that kind of thing as well. So,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
it's really good. It's powerful stuff to see people writing their own music as well.
Okay, well, look, stand by there, because you're going to play us out. What song are you going to play
for
us?
I'm going to play an original song called We Are the Stories.
Hang just 2 seconds and I'll say my goodbyes, and then we'll hear We Are the Stories from James O'Connor. So I want to thank Pat McDonough and the management here at the Collection Hotel today for looking after us. Give them a big round of applause. Great people. I want to quickly thank our sponsor, IE Domain Registry, John Fardy, our producer, our researcher, Simon Keane and Julia, Paul Buckland on sound, to Sifra and to Ben, John O'Donovan back at bass, Killian Ginnity on the video. Have a wonderful weekend. Enjoy the rugby. And James O'Connor now is playing us out with his original song. Thank you again.
Once upon a time in a fairy tale, we followed love like the Holy Grail. We made our way through the cold and dark. We found our feet and we left our mark. We are the stories you hear around, stories from people in an average town. Stories like yours, stories like mine, we are the stories we leave behind. Whoa, we are the stories we leave behind. Whoa, we are the stories we leave behind. Some days it seems we are deaf, dumb and blind. We are the products of our own design. Selling this world at our own expense. Screaming in vain, sitting on the fence. We are the stories captured in song. Voices of spirits from the great beyond. We are the stories you hear around. Stories of lives in an average town. Whoa, we are the stories we leave behind. Whoa, we are the stories we leave behind. We lose the plot, forget the signs. If we're not reading between the lines, we make our choices, we take the risks. We are by nature dramatic twists. We are the stories from young and old. Stories of people who were brave and bold. Stories like yours, stories like mine. We are the stories we leave behind. Whoa, we are the stories we leave behind. Whoa, stories we leave behind. Whoa, we are the stories we leave behind. We are the stories we leave behind.
Whoa, James O'Connor. Thank you, James.